When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Being a border guard, especially in Berlin, was seen as a plum job because obviously you're in an international city. It is a really significant, important job to the regime. So they'll choose the best of the best to do that kind of job. You'll get better pay. You'll get better holiday. The facilities and the equipment you use will be better. Again, for someone my age, I mean, I remember the Berlin Wall very well. And that's the thing. It must have been the same to them. And I did ask them that question was, did it feel completely permanent? Was it such a shock when it fell? Because so the Berlin Wall came down when I was doing my final year of my history degree. To me, the Berlin Wall was like the Himalayas. I mean, it was just permanent. It was never going. It was just not going to go. It was always going to be there. It'd been there my whole life. And so that's what I wanted to ask them. What did you think? And again, they were the same. They said, you know, this guy I told you about where I was interviewing him in his apartment, he said it was the worst day of my life.
Hello. On the evening of the 9th of November 1989, crowds gathered at six checkpoints along the Berlin Wall between East and West Berlin. At 10:45 p.m, East German border guards relented and allowed the people through, and as thousands streamed into West Berlin, the symbol of the Cold War was finished. But how did the wall get built, and what effect did it have on the people of Berlin? Joining me to answer those and other questions is Ian McGregor, author of Checkpoint Charlie and friend of the show, as we look back on the wall which seemed so permanent, but which in the end only stood for 28 years and fell nearly 35 years ago. Before I hand you over, I'd be so grateful if you could share this podcast with the like-minded. I've had lots of great feedback from the Patrick Lee Firmer episodes. So you can get in touch with me, history@aspectsofhistory.com or through X. And you can check out our Instagram to see examples of me at the Berlin Wall in 1990 in a massive fashion fail. But in the meantime, I'll hand you over to me talking with Ian McGregor. Ian, welcome back. Great to have you on again. This is for Checkpoint Charlie, your book, which is our non-fiction book of the month in the magazine.
Sounds fantastic. Thanks for having me back. Yeah, it's nice to be talking about this subject and book again. I haven't talked about it for a little while.
Well, that's good because actually, you know, chronologically, your first appearance here, it was obviously for Stalingrad, for your latest book, The Lighthouse of Stalingrad. And then we talked about the Eastern Front itself as the Soviets moved into Berlin. And now the Soviets are in Berlin, along with the Allies. So we're going to be talking about, really, it's about the construction of the wall. So we'll fast forward a few years from the Battle of Berlin. And actually, Giles Milton's spoken a bit about the immediate aftermath of the Berlin. But it's interesting, Checkpoint Charlie, the title of your book, is really one, the American crossing point into East Berlin.
Yeah.
But the book itself, it's more sort of about the Berlin Wall and during the Cold War, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's, as you just said, Giles's book is fantastic on post-war Berlin, just at the end of the war. It is a fantastic book. With mine, Checkpoint Charlie is obviously, it's such a world famous name, title, you could say, that it just made sense. If I'm going to talk about the Berlin Wall, and I'm talking about not just the military angle or political angle, but the human angle. So it's about all kinds of people in all types of jobs that lived in West and East Berlin. I just thought, well, all roads lead to Checkpoint Charlie. So, and you know, the name itself is just in the phonetical alphabet. It was just designated once the Berlin Wall came down. The Allies decided that A, B, and C. So it's basically Checkpoint Alpha gets you from West Germany into East Germany. Checkpoint Bravo gets you from, you've traveled through East Germany to Berlin, and now you're coming into West Berlin, the sectors, the international allied sectors. That's Checkpoint Bravo. But then the international crossing point within the city itself, where the wall was splitting the city after 1961, that was designated Checkpoint Charlie. That's, there was no other reason than that. That's, but it's obviously the name goes down in history. It's an exciting name because we all know what happened.
And so that means, therefore, from what you're saying, I would deduce you couldn't cross into East Berlin from the British sector or the French sector.
Well, yeah, you could. I mean, basically, there were, before the wall was up, there were dozens and dozens of crossing points across the city. It was a very free moving city. It was very liquid, you could say, because it's like any city in the world. People crisscross it all the time, get to school, get to the doctors, go to work, see a loved one. So even though you might have been an East German citizen before the wall, you could go about your business. And as long as you had your pass, there wasn't a really hard border in terms of what we know the Berlin Wall would become, as in big walls, barbed wire fences, guard dogs, machine guns, spotlights. Back then, before the wall, it was just a sentry in a sentry box on both sides. You'd have an East German Polizei or border guard, and you'd have his equivalent American, French, or British, depending on which sector you're going in. But that free flowing movement allowed, obviously, which was what we'll talk about, is it would allow you to try and escape undetected, unmolested. Whereas obviously post the Berlin Wall being built, it's a whole different ball game and you're seriously risking your life.
And that's ultimately why the wall was built, wasn't it? Because there was this sort of brain drain, really, wasn't there? A lot, too many people were leaving.
And actually, I was going to say, because some people said to me, what was the favorite part of your research? Because I did interview nearly 80 people from all walks of life and nationalities for the book. And they said, oh, and everyone quite naturally thinks, oh, it must be talking to the soldiers and the guards on the wall and everything else once the wall was built. But actually, I got more of a, it was more interesting for me as a historian to talk to people about what was life in Berlin like, East and West, before the wall went up, because it's great to capture that kind of atmosphere in the city. And to get back to your question, yeah, I mean, like I just said, because it was so free flowing, because there was no hard border separating East Germany, which really was the Soviet zone, and the Allied zone. So France in the north of Berlin, northwest, I should say, Britain, the UK forces in central west Berlin, and then the Americans in the south. You could literally walk in, like I said, if you had the right paperwork, or sometimes they didn't even check your paperwork. You could just talk to the guard and you'd walk through. But that led to, like as you just said, a brain drain, because outside of Berlin, the bigger picture, the big Cold War strategic picture, is that East and West were facing off. It was a very, very harsh, through the 50s and 60s, Cold War. East Germany had been established and now had a hard border along the whole frontier. So you're talking like nearly 1,000 kilometers overall. And that evolved from a barbed wire fence, which was the simplistic thing at the beginning, to minefields, armed guards roving around in armored vehicles and jeeps, dog searchlights, all that kind of, all the paraphernalia, like we think of North Korea nowadays, the separation with South Korea. It's that kind of thing. So it made it practically impossible if you were an East German citizen and you'd had enough of the system and wanted to go to the West for a new life. You're not going to be able to cross the actual physical national border to get you into West Germany. But the loophole, it was always a loophole before the Berlin Wall was erected. You could get to Berlin, and as I said, you haven't got a hard border. You've still got the international allied zones butted up against the Soviet zone. And if you had the right paperwork, or you kept a cool head, kept your nerve, and didn't run for it, you could cross quite naturally, unmolested, really. And that's what happened. So from when the hard border went up in the mid-50s along East and West Germany, and people started to migrate to Berlin, because that's the hole in the whole defense. We're talking about hundreds of thousands going into a couple of million East Germans escaped to the West through the loophole of no border being in Berlin. And that's the ultimate reason why the Berlin Wall came about, because it's a human problem. Because if you haven't got the workforce, or the, so shall we say, the intelligentsia, because Over 2 million people escaped from East Germany, half of which were under 25 years old, and the vast bulk of them were professionals. If your professional classes are leaving the country, that's the lifeblood of any economy. The country's going to collapse. So they had to do something.
And they decided to build the wall. So this is we're talking latter half of 1961, aren't we?
Yes, August the 13th. So it was a weekend, a nice hot summer's weekend, deliberately chosen to spring this surprise on the city because you've got tens of thousands of East German workers, but also supported by armed units of the East German army and the police, with Soviet troops and tanks discreetly way behind them, but there in case they're needed. They're going to impose themselves and build this enormous barrier through the city. Eventually, it's going to be 150 odd kilometers in length because a lot of people don't realize they obviously think, if you've seen Michael Caine in the Ipcress file and that kind of thing, or Bernard Sampson later on in the 1980s, you just see the wall through the city. But it obviously went round the city as well into the hinterland of East Germany. So it hermetically sealed in the three allied sectors in the west of the city completely. But at the beginning, it was just going through, it was just barbed wire supports with cement supports, sorry, stretching all the way through. And it cut off all the crossing points because like I said right at the beginning when you asked me, there were dozens and dozens and dozens of crossing points that East Germans and West Germans were allowed to use. But by the time this first iteration of the Berlin Wall, which was basically barbed wire and some cement blocks, when that went up in 61, the barriers that did eventually open within, months to a year of that barrier going up, there was only, I think, a dozen, just over a dozen checkpoints. Because obviously, the less you have, you're going to funnel people through. It's easier to manipulate them, monitor them, check them, stop them. That's the key thing, stop them. And that it just instantly, it's like turning off a tap or turning the sand clock the other way around, instantly stops the flow and you're in control again.
So was this because we're talking 61, late 61,
Yeah.
President Kennedy's not been in for long. And is this Khrushchev looking at the new American administration thinking this is a way of just testing as well to see how they would react? Because as you say, you've got Soviet troops backing up the construction
Yeah,
and
I mean, basically, because this brain drain had been going on, the Soviets, right back to Stalin, knew they'd made a mistake in allowing the Allies into Berlin. But that had been the agreement from Potsdam before the end of the war that the Allies would carve up the whole of Germany into sectors of occupation. Quite naturally, the Allies would be looking at the western half of Germany, and the Russians. They'd gone all the way up to the Elbe. The Elbe, the river, was the international joining point for Allied and Soviet troops to meet. But they'd gone, by the time you get to the Elbe, you're over about 100 kilometers to the west of Berlin. But still, Stalin allowed the Allies to come into Berlin. I think strategically he made a blunder. And that was the thing that those that succeeded him, Khrushchev was the first supreme leader, really, after Stalin. They had to suffer the consequences of that. So not only have they got an oasis of capitalism deep within their zone of control, and they were paranoid about that, but equally, as I was saying, with this huge human drain that's going through Berlin itself, sapping the strength of this new puppet state that they've created, East Germany, as their buffer zone against the West. From the mid to late 50s, Khrushchev's constantly being hounded by the leader of the East German government, Walter Ulbricht, just moaning at him constantly. He's just giving him the stats and saying, look at this. I've got this drain of humanity, of my country just leaving. And if this carries on, our economy's going to crumble, the country's going to crumble. What are you going to do about it? And Khrushchev knew he had to do something. And as you said, but once Eisenhower had left the presidency and is replaced by Kennedy, you've got a distinguished military leader who'd won the Second World War in Europe and was now this Cold War warrior who'd taken the mantle over from President Truman before him. He's now retired after his 2 terms. You've got this young, brash, 41, 42-year-old senator now taking over. And I suppose, arrogantly, Khrushchev thought he had the making of this guy. He knew what he was about.
He's liberal as well, which...
Liberal. Yeah, they'd met. I think this is a crucial point, which I talk about in the book. They decided that they would have a summit in Vienna in the June of 61, which was going to kind of thrash out various things that were troubling both of them. But at the center of it was this discussion of Berlin. Khrushchev needed to have a win from it. And I suppose it's seen, if you look back on it, especially if you look at some of the movies, you can find them on YouTube, you can see some imagery of the summit. He really did bully Kennedy over those 2 or 3 days. And because Kennedy came to the meeting thinking, you know, I'm a modern day guy. I'm a very polished politician. I've got the suaveness, the charisma. I can talk this guy.
We all breathe the same air.
Exactly. And he basically got battered black and blue. And he knew it as well. He said that afterwards. He said it was, you know, it was worse than his dealing with his father, Joe Kennedy. But the tragic consequences of that for Berliners was that Khrushchev came away from that meeting thinking, you know, Kennedy's thinking, I've got a serious problem here because this guy means business. He's threatened global war if we don't sort Berlin out. And Khrushchev came away from that thinking, I've got this guy sized up. I think he will, you know, I can push him around. I think we will try and do something. And I think he will back down. He's not going to go to war over Berlin. And that sowed the seeds and gave Khrushchev the confidence to give Walter Ulbricht's regime the green light 2 months later to prepare to build the wall. And I think, you know, you could argue quite confidently that's one of the big reasons why it did happen.
It's so interesting, the mind games, because especially when you take into account a little over a year later, the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is again Khrushchev trying to push Kennedy.
Yeah.
So how did Kennedy...
I was going to say that was much, much bigger. I was going to say they're playing for much bigger rewards in Cuba, I think. I think you're right. I think Khrushchev completely is that's hubris.
He underestimated how sensitive Cuba was.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What was Kennedy's reaction? Was it, you know, should we attack?
Oh, when the war went up, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, because again, in my book, I've interviewed people from both sides. I've interviewed workers who put the first barriers up, guards that were guarding them. And that's the thing. That's what you discover. It's when you look at a lot of the photographs, they're actually building this barrier inside their own territory. So there were always a couple of hundred yards inside the Soviet zone in East German territory, building this barrier. So legally, the Allies couldn't really do anything anyway. And that's what they're thinking. They're thinking, well, we can't actually go into their own area and tear these walls down. We can, but then we're breaking the agreements we've made. And also we're really pushing the envelope. But equally, the thousands and thousands army units and border guards that the East Germans deployed along the border, they're guarding their own people. They're literally, half of them have got their backs to the West looking at their own population because they were paranoid that their own people were trying to stop them and tear the wall down too. But getting back to Kennedy, I mean, that's one of the big things. They started with just building barbed wire fences because that was kind of tone the water. That's like when you're fighting a bull is you get the flag out, you're just seeing, will they react? And they didn't react. They just monitored. And that gave the East Germans the confidence to then carry on. And that's where you famously see them start building with basic breeze blocks and cement, the first iteration of a wall, which is really basic, you know. And obviously, there are more West Berliners getting right up close and arguing and causing a real ruckus than there are East Germans because they knew not to get too heavily involved. But, you know, the East Germans weren't silly. It was called Operation Rose, and Walter Ulbricht designated his who would become his heir apparent, Erich Honecker, to mastermind it all. And it was done very, you know, typically German fastidious fashion. And all the units were there. They were supported by armored units too. There was police, there was water cannon, there was everything you needed to quell any kind of social disturbance. But again, if the Americans, British, mainly the Americans and British, and the French too in the north, if they'd wanted to, I think if in that first 24 hours, if they'd sent some tanks and armored cars in to crush the fences, I think these Germans would have backed down because, again, there's a lot of people that I've interviewed, and there's some soldiers that were there on the day. They didn't even have any, there's a lot of them were carrying weapons that weren't even didn't have bullets in the chambers, and they were categorically ordered, you do not fire on the Allies. So, but as Kennedy said towards the end of the operation happening, a wall is a hell of a lot better than a war. If you had to give something up, it would be East Germany. He's thinking they're not touching, as long as they leave the international sectors alone and they're not encroaching upon us, and that's what they're doing. They're building this barrier inside their own borders. We won't get involved. We'll let them do it.
Okay, so the Allies are fine, but what about, you mentioned this, the people who are working on it and the border guards. I'm interested in them, and also, at a stroke, you have families separated, don't you?
Well, yeah, I mean that's the classic thing. I mean, if you watch the Tom Hanks film Bridge of Spies, the first half of the film where he's going into Berlin, you see that made real. So you've got, even though it was a simplistic wall, it was a very effective wall. First time it had been done to separate, a modern day city that way. And these Germans weren't playing around. The wall starts on the, so 13th of August is when they begin splitting the city in half, and it's less than 10 days later the first person dies. So that person died by jumping out of a window. That was Ida Zichmann. And because, again, what to try and I suppose it's that kind of logistic nightmare when you get a map of a city and you're thinking, okay, we're just going to drive a barrier through the center of the city. There will be obviously a lot of streets that your barrier will naturally be built across. So you're cutting off streets, train tracks, tram tracks, the underground, all that kind of thing was taken into advantage. But what they took advantage of as well was they used buildings as natural barriers as well. So there would be blocks of flats, offices, that kind of thing, right on the border. And therefore, on that border, people live in those houses. But because they've been designated the hard border now, before these German police have time to clear out the people that are living there, some of them are jumping out the windows directly into the West. You literally jump out of your window and you land in the West. And that's where, again, if you go on YouTube, you'll find plenty of films, clips showing that. Famously, there's a, I can't remember her name, but there's an 80-year-old woman who she's slowly making her way. She doesn't want to do it, but she's making her way down a blanket, or she's hanging for dear life off a windowsill. Her nerve goes and she won't let go. And there's two East German police have broken into her room, her bedroom, and they're trying to pull her up. And there's West Germans have got on, climbed up a grating, and they're hanging on her legs trying to pull her off. So she's getting pulled this way and that. And she does eventually, she eventually drops down and lands into a fireman's blanket. But it's those kind of human scenes. And you had, as I said before, because people were caught out because they're naturally following their routines. There, it was a weekend. Some of you have West Berliners, they've gone into East Berlin to see relatives and loved ones, and vice versa. Those people are now trapped on opposite sides from where they live, where their families are, where their loved ones are. How do they get back? And that's where you see these photographs and film clips of people crying their eyes out, frantic, thinking, how am I going to get back across? How am I going to get back across? And the very first, I'm trying to think, the very first death was Gunter Lifkin. And that's where I was saying that East Germans mean business, because Ida Schenkmann died jumping out of a window, but
Died from
Lifkin,
the fall.
yeah, she just fell, and she just died from her injuries because she missed the blanket that was trying to they were trying to capture her in. And so she just died naturally from her injuries. But she's the very first victim of the Berlin Wall, and that's 22nd of August. And then 2 days later, that's where, because it was the world saw it. That's where we realized that East Germans and the Soviets really mean business about the war, and you will be shot and killed if you try and escape. And that happened to a just a basic tailor from East Germany called Gunter Lipkin. And he was one of those guys who played the system very cleverly. I suppose he was a bit like a bit of a Del Boy, you could say, in that he was a qualified tailor, but the most of his clients and most of his work was in West Berlin. So because of the discrepancy in the foreign currencies, he would be earning a really amazing wage for an East Berliner in West Berlin because he's paid in dollars and he's paid in West German marks. So he's living like a king in East Berlin. And he had that summer been in the process. He must have thought the writing's on the wall, something's going to happen. So he was in the process with his brother of moving lock, stock and barrel from East to West Berlin. And he just got caught on the wrong side, like I was saying, on that morning of the 13th of August. And then he spent the next couple of weeks thinking, how am I going to get across? And he decided that the weakest point that he could see was, I'll swim across the canal. So like London, there's a huge river splits Berlin, and there's lots of tributaries and canals that diverge off the main river, the River Spree. And so a lot of them, at that point, very early in the life of the Berlin Wall, wouldn't have been hermetically closed off as they would be in the years and decades later. So that's where a lot of people did take their chance. They thought, if I can just get to the canal, swim across the canal, or if I can get to this part of the river, I'll swim across the river. So he tried, and he was shot and killed. And it was a big deal. It was international news, and it stunned the world. It stunned Berlin. It's thinking, wow. So if we do try and escape, they're going to shoot to kill. And that's how it went on over the weeks, months. So the first, I suppose, 4 or 5 years of the Berlin Wall's life in that part of the 1960s, if you look at the statistics of deaths, that's when they happened, because you've got to realize that, you know, the Berlin Wall that we know in 1989 that opened and, you know, and the Berlin Wall fell was a very modern, sophisticated killing zone if you tried to get across it. Whereas back then, like I was saying, its first iteration is just basically a breeze block barrier. It is, you know, stationed with armed guards and spotlights, that kind of thing. But it's still something that you think, oh, I fancy my chances. Maybe I could do it. And so that's where a lot more people tried their luck in the first 5 or 6 years to get across the wall and that what would become the death, what we call the death strip. Because it was, you know, you might be able to do it. So Gunter was the first victim.
So as a historian of Checkpoint Charlie, if you were to go back in time, you would try it in the first 4 or 5 years, and then after that, it's almost impossible.
Well, because it was still, yeah, because like I said, monitoring systems, the amount of troops, because you have to train troops to be border guards on something like the Berlin Wall. You'd have to be trained. You'd have to be trained as in to watch out for, how you'll be a sentry, what you'll watch out for, what equipment you're given to monitor the ground that you're supposed to guard.
Yeah, let's talk about these guys, because you've interviewed. They're nicknamed Vopos, aren't they?
Yeah, and Grenztruppen as well. I found it really, really both bizarre but very interesting in going to northeastern Berlin. It's a place called Hohenschönhausen. It's not only where they had a secret prison, which was discovered after the wall came down. That's where it was, though, for where they detained a lot of political prisoners. But it's where, since the wall came down, there's a vast majority of ex-East German guards and policemen live. And it is almost going back in time. So you go to these, what I did anyway, I visited several of them, and you go to these blocks of flats, and they're immaculate and they're in really good condition. And these, a couple of the people that I interviewed, one of them was he'd risen from just a basic border guard in the early 60s to where he was a commander of one of the main gates. And he had been in command of Checkpoint Charlie for a few years as well. And going into his flat was literally like going back in time. It's like that Channel 4 series, Deutschland 84 and that kind of thing. It was the decor he had in the house, the photographs he had up, the memorabilia of East Germany he had on the walls. And it was real kind of hair goes on the back of your neck up. It was just weird. But it was incredible talking to him. It was just really, because it really brought it home that, wow. Because obviously he was a believer, this guy I interviewed, who rose to be a commander. Yeah, it was seen, again, you've got to think about in East Germany where wages aren't great, lifestyle isn't great. It's only towards the mid to late 70s, going into the 80s, that you get a kind of consumer society, but still nowhere in comparison with the West in terms of the goods you can buy and the actual money you'll have yourself to buy things. being a border guard, especially in Berlin, was seen as a plum job for obvious reasons, because obviously you're in an international city. It is a really significant, important job to the regime. So they'll choose the best of the best to do that kind of job. You'll get better pay, you'll get better holiday, the facilities and the equipment you use will be better. So yeah, that's what it was. And again, for someone my age, I mean, you know, I remember the Berlin Wall very well. And that's the thing. It must have been the same to them. And I did ask them that question, was, did it feel completely permanent? Was it such a shock when it fell? Because as a teenager doing my A levels in history and then doing my degree, so the Berlin Wall came down when I was doing my final year of my history degree. To me, the Berlin Wall was like the Himalayas. I mean, it was just permanent. It was no where it was never going. It was just not going to go. It was always going to be there. It'd been there my whole life. And so that's what I wanted to ask them. What did you think? And again, it was they were the same. They said, you know, it's this guy I told you about, where I was interviewing him in his apartment. He said it was the worst day of my life. So there
Wow.
is a that's what I try and capture in the book. There is a yin and a yang. And your listeners don't have to worry. Obviously, I detail just how barbaric, ruthless, and evil the East German regime was in terms of policing and punishing its own people. But I still have to capture what they thought, because then that gives you a, you know, a complete overview of what was life like for everybody living in Berlin.
I had to mention one famous border guard who I guess is the opposite to the chap you spoke to, who decided to make a run for it himself. And his story is actually quite tragic, isn't it? Because whilst he does, I've forgotten his name actually. I should remember his name. What's his name?
Schumann.
Schumann, Walter.
No, I'm trying to remember it myself. Shocking, I can't remember it. But it basically he's if he had but put it this way, if he had an image rights manager, he
Conrad.
would Conrad Schumann, he would have been a multimillionaire, because obviously you go to Berlin today, you will see the famous image of him leaping across barbed wire from east to west to escape to the West in the first few days of the wall going up. And like I said, that's when it was you could take your chance and do it. And he could have certainly done it, because he's an armed border guard with his Russian famous Russian submachine gun. And that's the thing he drops to his side as he's leaping across the barrier. And again, you
But
go
did
to
the
Berlin.
machine gun give him a bit of momentum to get over the? Is that why he did
Well,
it
no,
that
he
first
throws
time?
it. He's literally as he runs and leaps over, he drops the gun at the same time. So that's the image that was captured. But that's the image that famously now you'll see it on T-shirts, bed blankets, tea towels, mugs, badges, everything. It's everywhere. You can't miss it. But like you said, his that kind of iconic tourist memorabilia overplays what I think is probably one of the most tragic stories to do with the Berlin Wall. So yes, he escaped in the first few days, and I talk about it in the book, because one of the key people I interviewed for the book was a West Berliner who worked for US intelligence, and he was American, right? He was naturalized American, because he moved there when he was a teenager. But he ended up being his bodyguard in West Berlin for the day that he had to stay there before they could whisk him back to the West, because they were paranoid that the East German intelligence services, the Stasi, were going to kidnap him or try and kill him, because it was a big PR coup for the West that one of their own within days leaps across. But anyway, his story is that he settled into life as best he could. He'd obviously left all his family behind. And then once the wall had come down, he tried to, I suppose, resurrect not just family relationships, because he'd left all his family in East Germany, but the friends that he had in his unit, but also friends from school, just the life he'd left in East Germany, he tried to connect again with it, which is a very natural thing to do. And he was shunned pretty much by everybody. And they didn't want to know him. They thought he was a traitor. And so he went into depression. And he ended up committing suicide. He hung himself. And that was literally a few years after the wall came down. And so you could say, you know, long term, you know, I haven't got the evidence, but I would say there are quite a few death by suicides amongst East German bureaucrats, police, intelligence, Stasi. I think there's a lot of people that couldn't come to terms with the world that they had helped build, or maybe the world that they had escaped and they'd hoped to go back to, but they were shunned. But they thought, well, what's the point? And they killed themselves. But he's the most famous stroke infamous story, which I think is terribly sad. And like I said, it's ironic that you can't escape that image. It's everywhere.
It is terribly sad. And another figure that's prominent in your book is a British officer who arrived when he was quite a junior officer, and he sort of returned. I don't know how many times he returned. He ended up being the final commandant in Berlin, British commandant in Berlin at the fall of the war. But what was interesting is that the British attitude to the East German border guards or East German soldiers was one of utter contempt, wasn't it?
Well, I think it was both sides, though. They didn't like each other. I think,
but they would prefer to speak to the Soviets as opposed to the East
German. Exactly. But that was especially in the first, I'd say, from 61 through to probably the mid to late 70s, definitely, because there were many years in the early days of the Berlin Wall. Internationally, East Germany wasn't recognized as a sovereign country. So, and we were still faced, the Allied sectors were still facing the Soviet sector. So they recognized through international agreements, that was the main reason. We had an international agreement with the Soviets that, A, they're not touching our sectors, and they weren't, but equally, it was still upheld that all sides would have free access to go in and out of the sectors. So French, British and American personnel, political and military, judicial personnel, as long as you had your ID, you could travel freely, unmolested, into the Soviet zone of East Berlin and come back again. And the Soviets could do likewise. They could come into our sectors and go back. And that was all fine. And there were a few problems I talk about at the beginning. But you're right. It was a lot of our forces were very much kind of, we're not talking to you guys, you're a puppet regime, we're talking to the actual owners of the city, which are the Soviets. They're the ones that are in charge, really. And that was definitely the case in the first decade of the Berlin Wall's life. But by, like I said, by the time you get to the 70s, we've recognized East Germany and they are fully operational, manning the Berlin Wall, manning the East-West German border as well. But all the while, even though they're there, all the while they're backed up by about 300,000 Soviet troops, a couple of thousand tanks, squadrons, you know, everything. They're backed up by the Soviet military force.
The British officer I mentioned, Robert Corbett, he's an interesting figure, a lovely man. You spoke to him quite a lot, didn't you, for this?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things. If you're a historian and you're writing these kind of books, you kind of go on your knees and thank God that you found someone like this, because it makes you just know instantly in one morning of an interview, you know, well, this could be the main eyewitness voice I would need for the book, because Robert's service is fantastic and it bookends the life of the Berlin Wall. I mean, he's just one of those lucky eyewitnesses to history, which I kind of discovered once I'd interviewed him a few times, and we've become firm friends now. As you said, he started his relationship with Berlin in the winter of that year of the war going up. So the war goes up in August 13th, and then by early October, he's in charge of a supply train going from West Germany through the hinterland, that 100 kilometers gap before you get to the western part of Berlin. He's there to take supplies through, which were much needed, because what I hadn't said was, even though the East German and Soviets didn't encroach on the Allied sectors once they built the wall, it didn't stop them playing silly buggers with the city itself in terms of all the essential supplies that were needed. They were very, very good at cutting off the city's electricity, water and gas supplies. And then they turned them back on because there was a problem with the generators, because all the main centers of supply actually came from the east of the city. into the West so they could govern what they would turn off and turn on. So they were doing that a lot. And that's just psychops warfare. It's to try and unsettle the city and drive them out of the city. That's what they hoped to do. They didn't do anything on the scale of Stalin's blockade that facilitated the Berlin airlift, but they did cause trouble. So that's where I start the story in the book is Robert is just this first lieutenant in the Irish Guards. He's got a platoon and he's been given control of a supply train that he's taking across East Germany, across, you know, what you call bandit country, into the West. And he knows he has to get it there because he knows it's dearly needed. And there's a big standoff. I won't go into too much detail. You'll have to buy the book to read it. But it's an amazing standoff, armed standoff between East German guards that are trying to arrest one of his men. And it's just very, very good. But then fast forward to 1989, and he's a few months in to, he's had a stellar career. He's risen through the ranks and he's now a general, a major general. And he was fluent in many languages, including German, as was his wife. And he'd been given lots of plum postings as well over the years. And they just thought, well, you're ready, you're qualified. We'd like you to be the next commandant of the British sector in Berlin. So he was the right man in the right place. And again, I won't go into too much detail about what he did, but he saved a certain serious outbreak of fighting in the British sector between paranoid Soviet troops who were being surrounded or terrorized, you could say, by West Berlin as the wall came down. And he stopped what could have been a really bloody firefight developing. But he was the commander. So he, again, was this eyewitness to what happened during those crucial days when the wall came down and how his skill and his character and his charisma made what could have been a real pressure cooker kind of ease down slightly. And so, he had good relationships with the French commandant and the American commandant as well.
Well, when the wall fell, the morning of the November the 9th, is Robert sort of waking up, having his bacon and eggs, thinking this is just another day?
Well, it was. I mean, because it happened at night. So basically, he's just doing his normal thing as a commandant. He would, because obviously he's at the top of the pyramid. So he's doing a lot of high-profile meetings, whether it was with the other commandants, where they have their once a month meeting, or he might be seeing some political dignitaries. I think the night of the 9th, he was at a party, from what I remember, for some dignitaries. And as I say in the book, basically what happened on the 9th was, towards the end of the day, by that time, East Germany is starting to fall apart in terms of the ruling regime. The communist regime knows it has to bend a little to its very frustrated, excuse me, population, who just basically want some more basic freedoms in terms of they're free to travel where they want to. They want less restrictions on visas, those kind of documents. That was kind of happening. And obviously, ultimately, they want the right for political freedom of expression as well. That had been going on for a couple of years, and it would come to its head that winter. So the government, which had now has got a new generation of leaders. So Egon Krenzer was there. He was like 50-year-old lifetime bureaucrat who'd worked in the system, was the new leader. He was trying to open up to his own people, but also to the West, to say, we will give daily press conferences to tell you what new initiatives we're going to be implementing to make life better for our citizens, but obviously to make sure we stay in power. And it was just this fateful press conference where one of his press secretaries, Gunter Schabowski, if you Google him, you'll find some great photos of a very stressed Mr. Schabowski at this press conference. Sorry about that.
I'll put these in the show notes. Link to the.
He'd actually come back from a sabbatical because he was mentally exhausted because he'd spent the summer firefighting all these things that were going on with the regime in terms of masses of East Germans escaping through the loopholes that were developing around the eastern borders of the country. So a lot of them were escaping the country via either Hungary, going into Austria, or even going into Czechoslovakia. So he'd been firefighting that and he was exhausted. But the day he came back from this, he wasn't briefed correctly by Krenzer, but they were talking about the news they were going to give about how they were going to implement the new visa system, which was still going to be elongated and would take weeks for people to get this much sought after visa that would allow them freedom of travel to the West or to any other country outside of East Germany. But he just picked up the basics of the information incorrectly. So when he's going into, and you've got to remember, this is a lifelong bureaucrat of the Soviet system who's used to giving the information and not being questioned. You just give the information. The press, the Eastern press, aren't going to ask you anything. It's like what you see with Putin today. They're not going to ask difficult questions. So he goes into this meeting, but he's facing international pressmen as well, and they are asking him difficult questions. So when he's asked, "And when does this new visa system come into play?" without taking any kind of advice from the other bureaucrats who were sitting either side of him, he quickly scrambles around, checks his notes, and picks up the wrong, just guesses more than anything else, and says, "Oh, it comes into effect almost immediately." And to cut a long story short, that starts the starting gun. People are hearing this through their own press releases, but also Western reporters have now left this meeting, gone to West Berlin, reported it. It's on West Berlin radio. It's on West German radio, which is now filtering through to East Germans. So thousands upon thousands, a flood of East Germans, not only in East Berlin, but outside of the city, over the next 24 hours, race to the checkpoints, thinking, "Wow, we can just travel through. We don't need a visa." And that's what it started. And therefore, again, a lot of your listeners will know this. That year, the beginning of the year in China, you'd had what the East Germans would call the Chinese solution, as in you've got similarly thousands and thousands of people congregating in the center of their capital city and demanding change, demanding the rights to do what they'd like for various things. And the Chinese had sent in the army and massacred them, you know, thousands of them. The East German regime actually had coined that, the Chinese solution. Do we use the Chinese solution? But thankfully, calmer voices prevailed. And they said, "We can't do that. Absolutely, we can't do that," even though some voices wanted to do it. And so they had to let them through. I mean, the chain of command disintegrated. You've got commanders on the ground in charge of the checkpoints. No one's answering the phone headquarters to say, "What shall I do?" They're having more and more and more people coming to the barriers. They're thinking, either I drive them away, or I have to let them through, or a disaster is going to happen. And that's why you get the checkpoints opening up. And that happened on the night of the 9th, going all the way through to the following day. And that's where you get the famous scenes of hundreds of Trabants driving through the barriers, thousands upon thousands of people coming back and forward, because West Berlin has wanted to see their relatives as well. And that's where Robert comes into play, along with the French and the American commandants, is how they would handle that situation.
So the role of David Hasselhoff then is being overplayed slightly.
To a degree, just teeny degree.
He can sing, stuff.
Yeah, he can sing a song. It captured it. I was going to say, I can remember it all. It was nice. And he gets a bit Donald Trump-like in claiming massive credit for international events, which clearly didn't happen because of him.
This has been great. I actually, I might put on Instagram, there's a picture of me, because I went to Berlin within a few months of the wall coming down, and there's a photograph that we went as a family, and there's a photograph of me chipping away on the wall.
Oh, amazing.
And I've got my fashion sense is coming through. I'm wearing a pair of brown penny loafers, bright green Bermuda shorts, and a dark polo shirt. It's embarrassing.
But 80s.
I'll put it on the Instagram just to shame myself. Yeah. But I remember it. It was amazing. It was absolutely the Soviet soldiers selling their uniforms.
Yeah. I mean, well, that's the thing. And it's, again, I interviewed some Soviet occupational forces as well who are in East Germany. And as I was saying about the border guards, it was a plum job. For Soviet soldiers in East Germany, that was seen as the best tour of duty you could do. Obviously, the worst would have been Afghanistan. But going to East Germany was where you had better facilities, you had better food, all that kind of thing. Even though it's still basic, it was seen as a really good posting, and that's what they were talking about. But again, they were caught out too, but they were ordered to stay in barracks. And I mean, that's one of the things I talk about in terms of credit to Gorbachev. making that key decision to say, we're staying in barracks, we're not going to get involved. And that ultimately, I would argue, was one of the main reasons that brought about a bloodless changing of the guard, changing of power, because the East German hardliners knew they were on their own. They thought, well, we can go down, go all guns blazing, but what is it going to do? We're still going to be out of power.
Yeah, it's such a revolutionary act to have been so bloodless is a bit of
it's
a miracle.
Incredible. Really, well, exactly. When you, it's just tragic where, I mean, you and I have talked about this before, but it's tragic where we've almost come full circle to where you've got Putin today trying to resurrect the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's just that, you know, you saw it when you were there as a young boy. I was the same. It's the excitement and the possibilities that lay ahead. It was just so amazing. And I just feel it's just been squandered. It's a shame. It's a tragedy.
It is a melancholy way to end it, Ian. This has been fantastic, though. Thank you.
Cheers. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget to check out my embarrassing pictures in Berlin in 1990. And please do share this pod with friends, family, and work colleagues. But until next time, thank you and good night.